quite sure that there will be questions for both of our speakers, so perhaps, Stuart, if you could come up and the two of you can wrestle for the mic. I'll invite any of you with questions to stand up and wave. It's a question here.
Yeah, my question is for Stuart. I'd like to ask a point. So, for example, World War I brought quite a few changes in the labor kind of relations, the labor markets in Europe. To what extent was that the case in Canada? You just didn't see that to be kind of touched upon at all.
Well, is there somebody here who's an expert on the Winnipeg General Strike? 1919, there was labor unrest. At the end of the war and soon thereafter, there was charges that business leaders were profiteering from the war and weren't sharing the benefits. I don't have a complete answer for your question, but there was labor unrest, and there was a major riot in Winnipeg, if I remember correctly.
Just related that, how much was there a connection to the Russian Revolution? Soviet Union, and then they, it advanced, and there's always fears that a country could go either way.
I can't answer that question. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. Very good question. Is there anybody in the audience who can answer that one?
No. I have a question you can answer, though.
I hope.
I hope you can answer. One of the most important historians Western Canadian historians especially argue, one of the most important interventions of the federal government in the economy during the Great War was to take over the marketing of wheat. What importance do you attach to that?
Well, so there was a marketing board. The Canadian Wheat Board was introduced in 1918 for 1 year. Was introduced for 1 year.
In 1919. But there was a government agency that was marketing Canadian wheat during the war as well.
Right, right.
But it didn't continue, but now we think, at least some farmers think, that's the only way to go.
Right, right. Well, there were wheat pools after the war, after that 1 year period with the Canadian Wheat Board before it was reintroduced in 1935. And so there was a major operation to get wheat out to Europe. The freight rates were controlled, and even the price of wheat in Canada was controlled in the last 2 years of the war. And so it was the wheat economy was a major operation. I don't think I have answered your question.
Well, no,
but,
I think you have, but the point is it didn't become a permanent feature of marketing policy.
Right.
This was a temporary wartime expedient.
Right.
By the federal government.
Yes. Yes.
So we're thinking of innovations that had dramatic changes. In the case of the federal government marketing Western Canadian wheat, it's a change that really only becomes permanent during World War II. And even then, it was only supposed to be temporary until the war ended. But we think of the government having been involved in marketing wheat for a long time in our country's history through the 20th century, into the 21st, but there were two or three false starts. The first one in the middle of the Great War.
Right. Yes, yes. And after it was abandoned, the Canadian Wheat Board was abandoned, I understand that we see the growth of the cooperative movements,
right,
and the local, the regional wheat pools.
Just a bit of a follow-up question to what Bill has asked. I hope you don't mind if I ask another question about wheat, but
there's too many Western Canadians.
Clearly, World War I drove up the price of wheat, as you showed, to levels, and probably nobody benefited more from that than Saskatchewan. Maybe that's why the rate of enlistment here was so low. In the armed forces, but also that and not, it's also, I think, understandable that, it fell drastically after the war. I mean, the rule of the resource-based economies is what goes up must come down. I mean, World War I was a bit like $120 oil. But what I have a little bit of more difficulty with is try to explain, like, what caused the wheat prices to be stubbornly low throughout the 1920s. Like, what were the factors that kept the price of wheat down in the 20s, which kind of indicated that the wheat economy was in trouble. Saskatchewan was in trouble long before the Great Depression. Like, why did they stay relatively low in the 20s? They never really came back higher. Was there more competition?
There were new sources of supply with the settlement of the New World. The interesting thing is that the world market was relatively strong in terms of demand. There were these supply shortages in Eastern Europe. There was still a fair amount of production in those countries, but there just wasn't enough surplus to export. And so that enabled Canada and Australia and Argentina and to another extent the U.S. to export a lot of wheat. Were prices low because these countries came on with their supply? Perhaps. Prices of all goods and services were falling as well, and so when we think of a massive drop in the price of wheat, we also have to think that there are massive drops in prices of other goods and inputs to production for wheat as well. But Canadian farmers did experience a rough ride after the war. But Canada had built the infrastructure to support a wheat economy. And so I don't know if that really answers your question. I don't think I really do have the answer to your question at this time, but it is an important question.
Question about PTSD. Have they made great advances in how they treat it? Like we're still having a lot of failure with soldiers, you know, taking their own lives. Like, what do they do to treat PTSD? And obviously, I don't know, is it working?
So that's a very good and very complicated question. There are very effective treatments that, when appropriately administered, work very, very well for post-traumatic stress disorder. The problem is that we have a very limited number of people that are able to administer those treatments and do so effectively. That is then coupled with the fact that there is still massive stigma against even mentioning that you have post-traumatic stress disorder would be a gross understatement even at this point. So I work with those types of patients who have PTSD, and just telling them that they meet the diagnostic criteria will quite often cause a patient to become extraordinarily distressed and break down in tears, pleading with me, saying they would like just about anything else because it's a life sentence and all of their friends will mock them. So if that's something that I heard from a patient a month and a half ago, I would argue that we still have such a pervasive problem with stigma that it's a profoundly complex problem. If you're not willing to come in and see somebody who does know how to provide the treatment, and there's very few people that do know how to provide the effective treatments that are available, that's part of why I think you're seeing such a massive, massive problem with treatment.
You know, one thing from personal experience, I know there's still a lot of stigma in the armed forces about anybody that has it, even now, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, wouldn't it be good if somebody incorporated that sort of stigma, like lessons about, you know, this could happen to you, like when you're educating those armed forces, because they do go to classes, that they should be made aware that, you know, this is nothing to be ashamed of, this should not be stigmatized, right? It seems to me they have to start where it belongs, right?
I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, myself and my graduate students and the teams that I work with are strong advocates of doing exactly that for not only the military, but also all of the first responders. And we are making progress in those areas, but it is very slow. Large-scale organizations like that change very slowly. And I do mean painfully slowly. It's like watching it's like it used to be watching glaciers shift. Now glaciers move faster, but it's very slow moving. And so we hope to make those kinds of changes, but it's at odds with all kinds of things. We run into interesting questions like if we talk about PTSD with people, will they be less likely to enlist in the various organizations? If I tell you that becoming an EMS person is going to mean that you are at a higher risk of post-traumatic stress disorder, will that not dissuade you? And does that not then possibly make it more likely that you'll develop PTSD? Now, the first one I can't speak to because I don't know. We've never tried. The second one, I can tell you that it does not cause problems for us to talk about PTSD. It does not make it more likely to occur any more than talking about cancer makes it more likely to occur. I'm glad you asked that. The short answer is no. Right? The longer answer is that, again, there are a small group of, an increasingly not small group of people that are professionals that advocate that we should be doing exactly those types of things, that we need to be paying attention to those things. In fairness, though, if I was to be as fair as possible to the government policy agencies, I have to say that we still have not done the kind of prospective longitudinal research that we need to do in order to provide the kind of screening effectiveness that would be well supported and readily picked up by government agencies. So we've known we've needed to do something like this for the last 100 years. The problem is that when you start having conversations about having 10 to 20 year research projects that are going to cost millions of dollars per year, $1 to $2 million per year, which when you compare it with the $70 to $200 million a year that we're spending on PTSD for RCMP alone, seems actually relatively small to me. But trying to convince people that we need to make those changes and that we need to be willing to wait for 10 to 20 years to get the full results, that can be a very big, big challenge.
Is there any medium to show support for PTSD funding?
Sorry, can you say, I didn't hear you.
Is there any medium to show support for funding, or at least help to decrease the stigma surrounding PTSD?
There are lots of different agencies that are working on it. There's not a... No, not yet. Not that I'm aware of. The Mental Health Foundation ribbon that they do have, which is one of the green stigma ribbons, that's actually probably the closest thing that we have right now, and I'm certainly a supporter of that. Unlike the United States that has a VA center that is set at a federal level and dedicated to post-traumatic stress and operational stress injuries, Canada does not yet have that. So I certainly hope we will have it soon.
Well, thank you, Paul, for very enlightening papers. I'm wondering, Nick, if you might want to talk or tell me if there's any sort of work done on this about the young women who actually didn't fight, of course, in the First World War, but a large number of them went to the front. And unlike the men who were sort of rotating them out, they were dealing with casualties on a regular basis. And just historically, and perhaps in the present, just gender, how are these women affected? And is there any sort of gender differences in how people deal with the situations of war?
I love that question. That's one of the things that my graduate student, Samantha Horsfield, is working on, and it's one of the areas of her interest for sure. I'm going to speak a bit to it. First of all, with respect to the development of operational stress injuries or mental health conditions after exposure to something, there's no clear evidence of any difference. It's not that men or women are more or less resilient. The symptom patterns afterwards may be different, but it's certainly no evidence that women are more or less resilient or that men are more or less resilient. Having said that, women are probably at a higher risk. They're still at a higher risk even today in serving because they are not only at the risk of sounding melodramatic, which it is not at all. They are not only at a risk from the other combatants or from the military exposure, they are also at risk from their comrades. the levels of rape and sexual assault and abuse for women in the military and paramilitary organizations are shockingly high, terrifyingly high. So they are at a much greater risk, largely because they are also at risk from the people that should be protecting them, which is unfortunate. Beyond that, there's actually, I haven't read as much about the women that served in World War I, and they, as you said, they did serve as nurses and as support staff, essentially, very near the front lines. I don't know that a lot of consideration was given to them, because we didn't give very much consideration to men who weren't directly injured by combat, so women that weren't actually seeing combat had no business being distressed. In the same way that we don't consider nurses, for example, who are quite often among the first people to reassemble us after an injury, to be vulnerable to distress. We don't think of them as first responders. We certainly think of the police, and so we should, absolutely, in the AMS. But the next person in line who's holding the person together, literally holding them while they die, that's a nurse. So I think there's a tremendous amount of research to be done in that area, and it's been neglected largely because of sexism and biases that we have with respect to mental health that for some reason we just haven't been able to put to rest, since we may or may not have desperately needed them to be there in 1914.
Oh. One more question.
I'm intrigued by one of the topics I saw on your list that we didn't talk about. And maybe there's a reason for that. Railways. What do you think the legacy of the Great War was Canada's railroads?
Very interesting question. Very good question. It's a question that I'd been interested in researching myself, but had never gotten to before touching on it during this work. The legacy of the Great War on the railways is quite clouded with events that happened before the Great War. Did we need 3 transcontinental railways here in Canada? Could we have used 3 transcontinental railways here in Canada? It seems like we were building railways as if we were going to have 12 million people on the prairies within a couple of decades. The other problem with building of those railways was fraud and corruption with the builders. And the government was, to my understanding, was hyping up the building of these railways to serve nation-building needs. And the farmers were very much interested in lots of railway building so that they could get low freight rates to ship their grain. So there's a strong political element to the railways that were built after the Canadian Pacific. And one of the problems that occurred was that the government gave loan guarantees to the Grand Trunk to build the Grand Trunk Pacific, and also to Canadian Northern to build its transcontinental portions. Whereas it gave the CP Rail land grants, subsidies, previous government-owned track, and so the financing of those railways was quite different. Now, the Canadian government got into problems with the railways before the CPR was developed, also with the Grand Trunk Railway. They were helping to finance the Grand Trunk in the east before there was a lot of demand as part of a nation-building exercise. And it also gave loan guarantees and took on debt from the Grand Trunk in the period from dates back to when Canada was the Upper Canada and Lower Canada. And so we didn't learn from past mistakes in the early 1900s when Laurier decided to allow those two companies to build their own transcontinental railways. Laurier wanted the two companies to work together and to have a second transcontinental railway, but the two parties wouldn't come to any agreement. They both wanted their own legacies and their own major railways, railway systems. And so Laurier decided to just allow the two to go forward with loan guarantees. Now, I don't know exactly if that answers your question,
well,
but
it's 1916, and McKinsey and Mann have come to the federal government wanting more help. Three words, just say no.
Right.
What would have happened if Warden had said no?
And he wanted to say no, because he didn't like what Laurier was doing before and allowing those companies to build, right?
Would we have been worse off if the Grand Trunk and the Grand Trunk Pacific and the Canadian Northern had all gone bankrupt?
That's a good question. My understanding is one of the reasons why they didn't want them to go bankrupt was because the British owned a lot of that debt, and they still wanted access to British funds in the future. There was a lot of political interference beforehand anyway, and so there was a lot of political interference in those operations.
So
we
end up with Canadian National Railways.
Yes.
Which was privatized by Chrétien in 1995 or whenever.
Right.
We've forgotten what foolishness we engaged in before the war.
Right. Yes, a very interesting question, very interesting situation for Canada.
Okay, I think we'll carry on this discussion upstairs over a glass of wine, hopefully.